Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
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 Yes, Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi. A podcast in which three disease-ridden gentlemen, well, I mean, technically we're all filled with bacteria, read science fiction, fantasy, or other books. Barry, what are we reading this week?
Andromeda Strain by Michael Crichton.
Ah, could you give me a reading from the back of the book?
The United States government is given a warning by the preeminent biophysicist in the country. Current sterilization procedures applied to returning space probes may be inadequate to guarantee uncontaminated re-entry to the atmosphere. 2 years later, 17 satellites are sent into the outer fringes of space to collect organisms and dust for study. One of them falls to Earth, landing in a desolate area of Arizona. 12 miles from the landing site, the town of Piedmont, a shocking discovery is made. The streets are littered with the dead bodies of the town's inhabitants as if they dropped dead in their tracks.
Wow, I'm kind of amazed there's not a lot of spoiling going on there, really.
Well, that's only the first part of the book.
Right, exactly. Usually they like give you the ending kind of on the back of the book or something.
Well, it's not like they, you know, disclose the two people who survived. Oh, wait.
Well, let's see. Yeah, this is actually, in terms of actual book language, the back of the book actually represents the book fairly well in that it's almost impenetrable, but it's still kind of cool. Anyway, Kevin, what did you think?
I liked it. I thought it was actually pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And considering it was written in 1969, so I'm sure it was pre-moon landing, unless they've changed time. And
are you sure about that?
Very sure.
Okay, great. We'll have to check out when the moon landing happened, if it did.
Well, that's what I mean. No.
It was just a sound stage in Hollywood.
Well, I mean, my assumption is he probably wrote it in 1968 or earlier.
Well, you know, of course, I take the compromise approach that they faked the moon landings on the moon.
I think you should try to put that idea out there. You're like, yeah, they faked it like this.
I mean, my entire thing is just the NASA mission documents with the word fake written in randomly.
I'd also like to point out that the moon is also flat. You only ever see one side of it. And
that's very interesting. I have a podcast to recommend to you that deals with this very specific issue.
The moon being flat?
Yes.
Or the Pink Floyd album.
Also that. Anyway, Barry, what do you think of the book?
I really enjoyed it. I think it's one of those classics, them classics.
One of them, their classics.
Yes.
Yeah, I really did enjoy it myself, although I was struck this time with just how man the whole thing was.
Yes.
I think there's like one woman mentioned in the book, and I think that she was referred to as the girl. I mean, she introduced herself and then her name disappeared from the narrative completely. Oh. It was like one of the assistants in the glove box room.
Oh, I thought you were referring to the automated voice.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Oh, yes.
The sultry voice who was like an 80-year-old woman and whoever.
65.
Something. Okay, I don't remember how old she was, but they implied she was...
Yeah, basically Siri.
Not young. Yes, basically Siri.
Not Michelle Barrett.
Well, actually, that might have been, thinking about it, which would have come first? When did Star Trek originally come out? 68?
Before this.
Yes, okay. So, he's ripping off Star Trek.
I'm sure that's what happened. Let's interview him and ask about it.
That might be difficult without a Ouija board.
Yes, I know.
I mean, this is a very convincingly written book. As such, it is basically a surgical after-action report or, you know, a government briefing document type of thing.
I mean, government gone right.
Yeah, exactly. Although, really, they're talking about the mistakes that were made. And one of the interesting things is, although these are all very, very smart men, and yes, men, they were also candid in this story about the mistakes that they made and the reasons for those mistakes, that one of them was tired or one of them, you know, had some sort of failing. And most of the time it all gets figured out by the end. And I'm not entirely sure if the mistakes actually changed the overall course of the book that much. But, it, you know, that's sort of the potential reason for this sort of government after action report format.
Yeah. I mean, the individual people in the book are all highly analytical, and that really comes through in the reading of the book. As I don't remember the movie being quite as analytical as well. So I thought that was an interesting change. And, you know, we are also mentioning the fact that this was a very man rich book, I guess. In the movie, they did make one of the scientists a woman. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if that's something that they had realized, you know, between the book and the movie. I don't know.
Could be.
Were they as, quote, woke as we are now?
Pretty sure not.
Yeah, I also liked the sort of insight into early computer, like, concepts, I guess.
Right.
And, you know, it's kind of like with, you know, even more so early Philip K. Dick, where they don't even use the word computer. It's like, you know, I don't remember the term now, but yeah, in here, there's a lot of stuff that is interesting. Some of the stuff is plausible, and some of the stuff is just what people kind of thought about computers doing, which is totally implausible for 1969.
Right. But
even if you had a supercomputer back then, it's like, no, that's not plausible.
Like, yeah, it's just like, and then we were able to balance a spreadsheet.
I mean, some of the stuff was, but some of the stuff was kind of just what I think people thought of, you know, the computer is a super brain that can do all this crazy stuff. And
right.
And there were several times they alluded to the fact that, well, the computer came up with it, so it's right, you know, which is kind of what I remember as a kid when there was a problem with billing, you know, with something, they would just say, oh, it's a computer error. And people back in the 70s and early 80s would just go, oh, okay. Whereas now if you said it was computer, they'd be like, so, yeah, you know, fix it. I want my money back or whatever.
Exactly. Well, that's sort of the interesting thing, is that Michael Crichton at least considers himself an anti-technology writer, but loves technology, loves it so very, very much, but is ostensibly at least calling out, you know, possibly the problems with technology, because there are 1,000 like miniature, very small, you know, malfunctions, and they tend to add up to really big things towards the end.
Right. There were several times where I guess we can do it in the spoiler section, but they pointed out, like you said, failings.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, okay, yes, that could have been really bad if this hadn't happened or something. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, oh, look, I think I saw a satellite crash. Barry, why don't you go bring it in here and we can all rip it open and lick it.
You mean again? Or a third time? I don't know. I mean,
sure.
Let's go check the office. I think there's several satellites back there.
Sounds good. We shall return, or not, for we are sci-fi.
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 And welcome back to our discussion of The Andromeda Strain by Michael Crichton. Took me such a long time to be able to pronounce his name correctly.
Crichton.
Crichton, yes.
Crichton.
I forgot to mention, just as we were starting to, actually, just as both of you were finishing this book and I was starting it, I was on vacation in Hawaii last week, and I was sort of thinking, oh, yeah, I wish I had downloaded that. I could have listened to it on the bus trip to the place where the wedding was being held. Then the announcement came up. Oh, yes, this is where Michael Crichton got married. I looked up later, and he was married 5 times. So it's just like, oh, what's happening this week?
Well, that's what we were wondering. Was it all always at the same place?
Yes, exactly.
It certainly would simplify matters.
Right, you don't have to worry about forgetting where we got married or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, remember that place we got married, honey.
You get bonus points if you do it on the same day.
Exactly. Wife number X. But
Joan, yes. Sue.
Oh, God. Anyway, yes, we're going to get lawsuit from Athia's estate. Apparently also there were parts of Jurassic Park shot there, so I assume that those two events are connected.
His wife was a dinosaur?
The wedding that we went to, the groom and the mother of the groom came in to the theme of Jurassic Park being played on a ukulele, and they sort of mimed being dinosaurs as they walked down the aisle. It was pretty cool, actually. But anyway, gorgeous sight. I just wanted to throw that in there. I don't really have any real point there. So I thought that this was a brilliant novel, but definitely, as we said earlier, very man-heavy. man-rich, what did you say?
Yeah, I think I called it man-rich, yeah.
Yeah.
Not a man-witch, but no. Man-rich.
My favorite part was when they were talking about the odd man hypothesis, and it was definitely the odd man hypothesis because they went through the various types of people and their decision-making capabilities, and they had, like, married man, you know, really low percentage of the time, married woman, I think even lower, unmarried woman, like, you know, 0.5% of the time made the right decision, and then unmarried man, 0.9% of the time.
And yet the janitors, you know, outdid them all. right?
I forget about the janitor.
The janitors are sort of added on as a, you know, when they were sort of talking about the professions as, you know, as,
right, they broke it down
as a tuple of, you know, gender. And they're like, it turns out that, you know, unmarried male janitors make the decision like 99% of the time.
So it really shouldn't have been given to one of the doctors. They should have just had the guy sweeping up upstairs. It's just like, oh, yeah, the alarm's going off. Should we blow up this place? I don't know.
Swallows the key.
Yeah, sounds exactly. It's like Homer sitting there accidentally hitting something.
Yes. But so what did we think about the odd man hypothesis, being more or less odd men ourselves, although some of us are married?
Well, I was sort of wondering, was this supposedly based on some real research, or was Michael Crichton just like, was he in between weddings or something? Like, you know, what was going on? Or
I thought it was certainly an interesting element of the book. I don't know if it was based on any real research, but maybe just sort of anecdotal, you know, thinking on Crichton's part.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the way they gave it in the book, it makes sense because they're like, well, you know, people who are married, you know, they might be concerned about something like their families or whatever. And like,
sure. So they kind of brought this guy in partially because it was important that they have an unmarried member of the team.
Right. They're like, oh, he doesn't have to worry about anybody else. He could just be like, okay, let's nuke the site and save everybody instead of worrying about something else. But
I mean, that was another interesting part of the way they had set that up, was that the bomb was already activated. You know, once, you know, the person had to make the decision, right? So they had to make a conscious decision to turn it off as opposed to turning it on.
Right.
And then there was a cost overrun or something like that. There was a scheduling error where they didn't have all of the
Pedestals.
Cancellation stations put in all the various areas. And it's just like, okay, let's disarm the bomb then.
Yeah, that, I mean,
run
that
faster.
That seemed like it was it was both kind of an artificial, you know, part of the book. Like, well, we need a way to make it more, you know, tense, but also like completely believable with government contracting.
That's true.
I wasn't quite sure which way to go.
They'd also mentioned some other elements that hadn't been completed due to, you know, basically construction errors.
Mm-hmm. It's just like, well, one agency wasn't talking to another agency. That never happens. Like,
the Department of Seals, it's not communicating with the Department of Doors.
Yes. As we were walking in today, we were coming up with the hypothesis that maybe the biological seals were originally supposed to be marine mammals or something like that.
They're great seals. They're biological.
And this whole thing has now mutated to attack seals.
Need a new seal every time you open and close the door, because you've got to have a fresh seal to get wedged in there.
Well, you see.
Well, I thought that, I mean, part of the whole thing with the book is it kind of turns out, well, we didn't really do anything, got really lucky that this didn't like wipe out all life on Earth or something.
Exactly.
And that's kind of like, the report didn't kind of, between the lines, we didn't really do anything except we know a little bit more about it now.
Right. There was a certain amount of, oh, well, if they just hadn't done anything, they mostly just, you know, managed to keep from blowing themselves up several times was their major heroic thing.
Right.
And then the whole thing is just mutated into something else. And then
he gets shot with karate.
But it's only a small dose because it's meant for small animals.
Yeah. Right. But he gets hit several times.
Yeah. He's like, oh, I better run in that thing again. Having a bad day.
They're having like recreational runs through the central tube to get gassed out on curare.
Don't think that there are any recreational curare users yet, but why not?
Challenge accepted. I mean, there was that one guy who basically, what is it, pressed sterno through a cheesecloth.
Oh, yeah, squeeze. Yeah, Peter Jackson. I won't forget his name anytime soon. Sort of imagining a New Zealand filmmaker.
Yes, yeah, so I'm sure he wasn't trying to talk about the same guy.
I don't think so, no.
It's not alcohol. It's alcohol and methanol.
Yes. Well, you know, right. It's sterno. And
he's like, well, you know, I don't know. Might not be good for me, but it made me feel better. So, yeah, that was pretty hilarious.
I kind of like that guy.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He was just like, what? Like, well, you know, it was not good for you. He's like, oh, yeah. Well, what are you going to do? He's like, I don't want to live forever.
His sort of daily regimen of, you know, a can of sterno and a bottle of aspirin.
I know. It's like, damn, that's a lot of aspirin.
I have some vague memory of in the movie, they introduced that concept by, you know, the baby is crying and they have the old man saying, you should give him some squeeze. That had quieted him right down.
Oh, wow. They're like, really?
I mean, it's not like, you know, dipping your thumb in the whiskey and of course, shoving it in the kid's mouth and
snake squeezins from Wasteland.
God.
See, I knew I could bring in somehow.
I have every confidence in your ability to bring in Wasteland into the most unlikely of situations. Yeah. So one of my kind of issues with the book is there are four guys and I could not tell them apart.
Their accents.
Like, you know, we had Jeremy Stone and Charles Burton and Peter Lee. I mean, one of them had epilepsy and then the rest were...
It was until the end that I started to get, you know, it's like, okay, I think this is the epilepsy guy. Okay, this is the guy who has the key. And then there's the other guys that I kind of confused.
Yeah. I mean, this wasn't a particularly long book.
Right.
So I don't think the intent was to develop the characters as much as, you know, propel the story forward.
I mean, we had like the main guy who was like, you know,
Dr. Stone.
Yeah, the super smart guy who was like just naturally, you know, amazing at everything.
It didn't actually mention that he was 7 feet tall, which Michael Crichton was actually.
Was he really that tall? Well, was he pretty tall?
Really tall. I mean, I don't know if he was over 7 feet, but he was pretty close to it. The characters were kind of bland cardboard cutouts, but then again, yeah, but it was sort of written as a post-action report.
Right, and that's kind of like you would expect anybody to come across that way.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was sort of a very dry presentation. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't actually own a physical copy of the book, but I kind of imagine that there's, you know, memos in there when they're reading about statistics and...
Yeah, that part. The guy did an amazing job reading tables from an Excel spreadsheet, basically.
This actually comes across a little bit better when you're actually reading at least the Kindle version, because they've got all kinds of supplementary materials and so forth.
Right. This was the 1969 version of the new books that have URLs and email addresses. And then like in the books where they have to read out like IP addresses and you're like, oh God, how many of these are there going to be?
And here's the send mail hash of.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And there's been more than one book like that.
5CD4982.
Really should, you know, if we ever publish a book, we should just have one chapter that's just like, oh, and the rest of this chapter is random letters and numbers.
Like, this is like, you know, the Apple II ROM. Just read out in hex.
Just to torment some poor reader.
And we've included it in Noctil in the next chapter.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing about the 3 minute, you know, stop time for the nuke thing, that kind of struck me as optimistically low, even in the best circumstances, even if there weren't missing stations. I'm like, I mean, what if the guy is like sleeping in the one of the weird decontamination showers or whatever? It's like,
what if he's putting a suppository in?
Yeah. It's like, you know, I'm sure there are many circumstances where it's like, unless they put, you know, next to every, you know, toilet, there's the key thing or something like that. You know, you're just like, oh crap, running through the halls.
Oh, this is something that also confused me a little bit. Sure, I understand the concept of, like, you know, they've got this base and they've got these guys that are going to, you know, fly in and deal with the situation. And I even understand that they've got sort of a fake thing on top of it. But then, like, they go down to level 2 and they get a checkup from a doctor that's there who appears to have been there, like, just right. Underground the entire time. Just like, oh, yep, going to work today, honey.
Yeah, that's true. It did seem like it was staffed with other, you know, people that were normally there. So you're like, okay.
Did they just like live there 24/7?
There were other people that lived up above the base.
Sure.
You know, doing sort of like the what is it they call it? The agricultural desert studies.
Yeah. Sure.
Which I thought was pretty actually a little interesting. I could have stood to hear a little bit more about that.
Like, we do a little segue. We're like, you know, spinoff book about that.
Well, it seemed a lot like, you know, the Spies Like Us bit where they go into the secret underground base by going into a drive-in movie theater.
It does have a certain amount of like Men in Black type.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now into the tool shed.
Yeah. Well, they basically go into the back room of the facility that's on the top, on the surface, and, you know, the whole room basically sinks down. Right. I'm kind of curious what the first instance in media is of, you know, the entire room being the elevator.
Yes, I don't know. I'm willing to give him credit for it because, I mean, there is a sort of a lot of foundational stuff to this. I get the impression that a lot of my idea of what a cool base would be comes from Michael Crichton, novels of various kinds, because he loves himself a cool base.
Well, there was an entry in the Wikipedia article about this book, obviously. But one of the things they mentioned is that some of the base ideas came from a movie called The Ipcress Files, I think.
Oh, sure.
I haven't seen that, but now I want to go see it.
It's got Michael Caine, I think.
Yeah, I think it's from the 50s, I think. I don't know if it was based on a book or not, but because the Wikipedia entry only mentions the movie.
Okay, that makes a certain amount of sense. I don't really remember if I've seen it or not. And I'll spare us all my Michael Caine impersonation.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, actually, it's, you know, now you mentioned this, it is a really cool base, and I really like the whole concept of, and then you have to go through the airlocks to the more clean and more clean and more clean, but it doesn't really pay off except a tiny bit when he has to like come, go, you know, break through the central shaft to get up to the higher level.
Right.
Because it's like, you know, and I think maybe the movie might have had more of a payoff. Like, the, I don't really remember, but I wanted to say I remember them using it at least once or something, whereas here, there was never really an issue where it's like, oh, we need to get up to the higher level really quick, and we can't. We have to wait or something.
It's all pretty much business as usual until the end.
Right. And so I guess what I'm saying is it's a cool base in setup, but we never get a payoff really except for that Curare run at the end.
Yes. Well, and as you point out, it's what you might call an Indiana Jones plot. I mean, the entire movie of Indiana Jones would have functioned just fine without Indiana Jones. He's just there, you know, his big move is to not look at the thing at the end.
Well, he finds it, right? Figure eventually they would have found it, I guess. Like,
well, I mean, it's you just simply search the entire planet, right?
Right.
But I mean, wouldn't the Nazis not finding it have been better? I mean,
by definition, it'll be in the last place.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I mean, it could have been, you know, they're the Nazis. They didn't find anything.
They just went all home sad. And
they are sad. Yes.
Well, I see the crossover here is John Williams.
That's true. I think that the big breakthrough that it didn't live very well in acid, that didn't really pay off at all, did it?
Yeah, I mean, the discovery was... The usefulness of that was very short-lived because, you know, they then quickly realized that it had mutated to something else.
Right.
And, you know, no longer really posed a danger to Earth-based life.
Yes.
So
did pose a danger to the space program, and I don't think that I'd understood that the first time that I read the book.
Yeah, they seemed to kind of – that seemed to be the implication at the end was that, something like this could happen that prevents us to go out into space, or there might be more dangers in space, which was a Blake 7 episode.
Well, I mean, it's also kind of interesting now because we actually do engineer bacteria to do interesting things like, you know, consume oils for oil spills, right? You know, I'm sure there's also some other instances out there of engineering bacteria to do interesting stuff. So, you know, the idea of, you know, a rubber eating bacteria really in our day and age isn't that far-fetched, but the fact that it's, you know, extraterrestrial was, I thought was kind of neat.
Yeah. There was this one NASA mission where they had, I think, gone into the tail of a comet or something like that and done a sample return. And I just remember they were trying to, and then the capture method was completely insane because they were trying to come back and they were flying along with a helicopter with big nets to try to catch this thing. I think it was like Project Stardust or something like that. At least it wasn't Project Icarus. Never be involved in Project Icarus.
I don't know. The word Stardust is coming up an awful lot in our podcast
lately. It is, yes.
Stardust.
But I forget exactly what it was. But then, of course, they installed something backwards or messed up the altimeter. So it just went splat on the desert floor.
And just got spread everywhere. And
I'm just like... Didn't you guys watch the Andromeda Strain?
They should have just called it Project Andromeda.
They should have called it Project Scoop and been done with it.
That would have been hilarious.
I mean, isn't that kind of what happened to Scotty's remains?
But I mean, you know, he was trying to have them scattered. He was just hoping for something a little bit grander.
Like across, was he aiming for the moon or the sun? I can't remember.
If he was aiming for the sun, he was significantly underpowered.
Sorry, I just had some really bad imagery in my head.
Okay.
Some sort of like rocket powered, like coffin or something.
Well, that's more or less what he had, but why are we talking about this?
Well, his remains did get scattered across the Southern California desert.
Right, which they kind of didn't want to admit.
Maybe that's what actually happened, that Scotty's remains collided with this NASA mission.
Maybe Scotty is the Andromeda Strain.
He did morph into something, I guess, and then...
Yes. Okay, Crazy Jimmy Doohan. That was like his Canadian Air Force nickname. He was apparently a daredevil pilot back in the day.
Hmm. Learned something new every day. I also really like the decontamination procedure. You know, they sort of like scrub, you know, physically on the outside, and then they kind of swim through this, you know, pool that doesn't, you know, it's completely full in the room, right? So that they have to be exposing all of their skin to the fluid, and then, you know, on the other side, they're handed all suppositories to make sure that their guts are all, you know, decontaminated as well.
I mean, I guess I wasn't entirely sure why the entire base had to be so sterile. I mean, I don't know if they, was it so important that bacterial growth be inhibited? Was this thing even a bacterium? I wasn't sure.
I think it was that you don't know what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. So they want to make sure it's as less interaction with whatever.
I guess, and then
as pure as you can.
I think one of the main reasons they were talking about it is they didn't want to do cross-contamination of terrestrial bacteria with extraterrestrial bacteria and confuse the...
Mm, that makes sense.
...the experiments. So I mean, I'm just kind of curious, you know, how they decontaminated all the Norway rats and the monkeys. Do they all get little suppositories? Well?
Yeah, that's the janitor on the top level that has to do that job.
They breed them there.
You know, it's like the...
Giving suppositories to rats, and then, you know, the alarm goes off, and he's just like, should I put this key in? Maybe not.
Well, you know, it kind of makes me think of, like, you know, my talk with the petting zoo people where they were basically using Valium.
Experiencing fear.
Well, I had asked the people running the petting zoo how they keep the animals so calm with, you know, all the screaming kids running around, and the guy kind of smiled and turned to me, and he said one word, Valium.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, how do you get them to eat it? And he's like, they don't eat it.
Well, that's important. I'm glad we talked about that.
Yeah. So,
would you like a Valium?
No, not that way.
How did they sterilize the old man and the baby? Did they just ignore them? Did they lower him down the central shaft or what? They never really explained that.
Right. I assumed that they had some kind of. Yeah, I definitely got the impression that they hadn't gone through the whole sterilization process, but then again, they're in complete containment zones, so.
Right, well, that's what I was saying. Maybe they did get lower down the central shaft somehow, but, hey, catch! I mean, I don't know.
Just drop them down.
I'm sure it was explained in the book. There wasn't a whole lot. Yeah, exactly. It's just like, okay, now, old man, you have to crawl down here really fast. Okay, baby, you're next.
Alternate video game implementation of Andromeda Strain.
I'm sure that somebody's done the Andromeda Strain Castle Wolfenstein type of game.
That sounds really awesome, actually. And the problem is now I could imagine lots of things as like old adventure games, 8-bit adventure games, and think how awesome it would be.
I'm assuming that's just what the world looks like through your eyes. That, you know, Barry and I just sort of have vaguely block shaped head.
Allspice, or like they call the Castle Wolfenstein.
Kaput. Right. So, did we have favorite scenes we wanted to talk about
that we haven't already discussed? I don't know. I guess that bizarre Kirari scene was just bizarre enough to kind of stand out.
Right. I vaguely remember that in the movie that it was lasers, or I thought it was lasers, which made less sense to me than the Curare, but it probably was Curare and I just misunderstood it.
I don't recall what they were using in the movie.
And then he stumbles through the upper floor, and I guess that was that the same woman or a different woman that sort of like, she sees him, she runs away from him, and then we're like, okay, what's happening here? And later on, it looks like she was going to get something to help him, but from his point of view, it seemed like she was like, oh, crap.
Maybe she's going to go get her Curare gun.
Exactly.
Escaped scientist.
Attack.
I'm totally going to get a bonus for this.
And then he just sort of, you know, later on, he couldn't remember how he'd stopped them all from dying by turning the key.
Yeah, let's see. I did kind of like when the SEALs all started failing and Leavitt had his epileptic episode, rather like you two are doing right now. Sorry, yes. They really like the word SEALs.
We're just giggling about some SEAL jokes we made off air.
Yeah, actually, that's one part that bothered me about the book was that it said, oh, this SEAL failed, and then they said another SEAL failed, and then they were just sort of like not getting it that something was like happening to all the SEALs. They were
that's sort of cascading
weird.
Outwards.
Yeah, yeah, after like, you know, they said, oh, one failing, that's, you know, bound to happen. But then after like two or three failed and they were both like kind of oblivious, I was like, okay, that seems sort of obvious now. Like,
well,
you know, it reminds me of some comic I was reading where it's just like, oh, hey, that's weird. That camera failed. Oh, and the next camera failed. Now that's really annoying. How are we going to tell if somebody's sneaking up on us if our cameras keep failing? Look, the next one failed.
Well, to be fair, they were sort of being mentioned by the computer by number,
right?
And Dr. Stone, sort of being the sort of chief architect of this whole project, was the one who first realized that, you know, that it was sort of radiating outwards, because, you know, no one else could really tell just by the numbering mechanism,
right?
You know, which I was listening and I'm like, I mean, I know what's happening because I've seen the movie and,
right, and we've seen the countless ripoffs.
Yes, we know where this is going, right? But, you know, I kind of tried to put myself in like one of the other people's, you know, little paper slippers at this point.
And yes, the countdown ends at one.
That's right.
Oh, yes. Oh, so the usual questions. Was there tea? Nope, no tea.
Not even sugar.
Definitely no sugar in the tea. Which character would you want to be and or who would you be? I would want to be the Andromeda strain. Because it wins.
Completely benign.
Well, it is benign and just attacks anything made of rubber.
I want to be. Wow.
Okay, that could go a lot of places.
I'm not even sure what joke I'm making, but I figured that you guys would come up with something.
There are so many places to go with that.
Yes.
Yeah, just it'll mutate eventually.
I mean, I kind of initially thought I'd want to be the nuclear bomb, but I didn't actually get to go off and the planet as we know it.
Mm.
So I'm kind of a little disappointed by my choice now.
Nuke us, interrupt us.
You could be the Ferrari
after the melted rubber.
Well, the Dr. Mark Hall does like save the day, sort of. So he's the only one who does something that actually gives them a result.
Right. He keeps
by preventing everyone from dying. I would be one of the guys that worked at the agriculture research station on the genetic corn.
All right.
Those people who will randomly all be vaporized for no apparent reason.
They're sitting there working away, doing their day job like they're supposed to. All of a sudden, the nuclear bomb goes off. Like, guess I won't make it home for dinner, honey.
I know. I guess they get hazard pay.
Yeah, that was sort of a neat thing in the beginning where it's just like, oh, yeah, you know what you're supposed to do if we don't come back. It's just like, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to report over to the base. And, you know, there's a whole lot of explanatory text saying, yeah, what that meant was he was supposed to hover over the base until somebody shot him down.
Right. And then there was like there's an F, you know, 14 or something like that was waiting in the wings to just like, you know, shoot him down if he didn't go back there.
Right. Now, of course, if I had written this book, I would have like the rest of the book would be like continuing that chain endlessly. It's just like, and then there was a giant, you know, ground-based, you know, blaster to take out the fighter if it didn't fire. And if that didn't happen, there was a satellite that was designed to destroy them.
So I just sort of remembered something about, you know, we were having a conversation, I think before we started recording, about, you know, all the failures that happened in this book,
right?
You know, of technology. And I think we kind of focused a lot on sort of like the computer failures,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, sort of the biological failures, but there was also a mechanical failure, which was sort of the teletype machine that they had,
mm-hmm.
where the paper had been sort of jammed between the print head and the bell. So they weren't actually being told about
the
incoming messages that they were supposed to be responding to.
Cause right.
You know, at some point the president's like, you know, I have to think about whether or not we should just, you know, set the bomb off remotely or not. and then I guess one of the generals was saying, he's like, well, he's really like a sort of anti-technology president.
Right.
He snuck in and put the thing in there, the piece of paper.
But it's one of those things where I'm not sure what message to take from that, because they later decided, no, we shouldn't nuke the town.
Right. Because this computer thing delayed it. Well, it didn't delay, but it delayed them complaining about it. And then because of that, they at the last second, they figured, oh, make sure that doesn't happen. So I guess maybe it's an anti-nuke message or something. Because look, we didn't know when that was the first thing. You know, what could possibly survive it? You know, well, apparently this alien creature would or something.
Would have thrived on it, yeah. Right. But I mean, the president also sort of took credit for, you know, not, you know, jumping the gun, so to speak, you know, and just setting the nuke off after, you know, after the whole thing was done and said, right? You know, he kind of said, he's like, well, you know, it was a good idea that I just waited and exercised some patience and...
I mean, and yet at the same time, that is one of the things that might have, I mean, if they had gone in and, I don't know, acid attacked the town instead, then maybe we could have still had a space program afterwards, but, you know, just basically jumped the gun by a few years.
Yeah.
We kind of have a space program now. It's
we send stuff into space all the time.
Yes.
Just not, you know. That useful stuff for exploration and whatnot.
Right.
It's all for, you know, beaming media back down to the planet.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else that we wanted to talk about? All right. Well, I think it's time for us to experience the final symptoms of this version of the Andromeda strain. I'm told that if you don't die immediately, then the next symptom is madness. So this probably has been just a big delusion that we've been having.
Well, we have been chugging Sterno, so it might save us.
Sterno, yeah, pass, and aspirin.
Pass the squeeze.
It's either that or you cry a lot, so you make yourself acidotic.
Oh, that's what I've been going for.
Just start screaming.
Just start screaming.
It's the trifecta.
Just start screaming, screaming, screaming.
We're doing Finding the Horror of Nemo. All right. Well, then, assuming that we all don't die in a plague, or that we do, we shall return, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi. I know what I'm voting for.